As the communists moved west, they carried out brutal massacres on a regular basis in Belarus, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, and Russia. Thousands of innocent intellectuals and thought criminals were slaughtered. Already when the communists claimed eastern territory of Poland, thousands of Polish soldiers were brutally captured by the Red Army. Stalin then ordered 15,000 Polish officers imprisoned in special camps at Kosciusz, Ostaszków, and Starobielsk, partially because he feared that these men might have the potential of starting a national movement capable of resisting the communist takeover of Poland in the future. On the 5th of March 1940, Stalin and Kaganovich signed an order to execute Polish army and police officers. The Jewish secret police chief, Lavrentia Beria, was an infamous butcher who committed his crimes by blaming them on the National Socialists. He sent 20 million people to slave labor camps. Beria then masterminded what would be called the Caden Forest Massacre. In April 1940, Stalin ordered more than 10,000 Polish officers taken into the Caden Forest near Gnaizdovo village, a short distance from Smolensk in Russia, where the victims were executed. The Poles were marched into the forest wearing their uniforms, with their hands tied behind their backs, and were then shot in the back of their necks. Thousands were buried in huge mass graves. Many of these victims couldn't later be recognized by their relatives due to the fact that their bodies and faces had been brutally demolished by the Red Army. Some Poles were executed in the Kalinin and Kharkov prison and elsewhere. Of the total killed, about 8,000 were officers imprisoned during the 1939 Soviet invasion of Poland. Another 6,000 were Polish officers, and the rest were arrested Polish intelligentsia that the Soviets deemed to be intelligence agents, landowners, saboteurs, factory owners, lawyers, officials, and priests. An estimate of about 22,000 of the best Poles were killed by the NKVD in this massacre alone.
Odpust nám naše viny. Jako i my odpustíme našim viníkům.
When the Germans discovered the mass graves in early 1943, they brought in a European Red Cross committee called the Kadian Commission, comprising 12 forensic experts and their staff. But at the Nuremberg trials, the Soviets just blamed the Germans for perpetrating the Kadian massacre, and the British, French, and Americans just let them do it. Numerous German officers were wrongly hung for the murder of thousands of innocent Polish nationalists, murders that in fact were committed by Stalin's NKVD. President Roosevelt purposely and deliberately covered up the evidence of who really committed these crimes. That such corruption could have been going on in high levels of the US government during those years proves that we should question official evidence of the Holocaust and World War II. The Soviet report, which blamed the Germans for committing the Kadian massacre, was listed at Nuremberg as 054 USSR, member of the Special State Commission, academic N.N. Burdenko, a member of the Special State Commission, Mithropolitos Nikolai, two obvious liars with an agenda, signed this report. These were the same known liars who also signed the official Soviet report on Auschwitz that was listed at Nuremberg as 008 USSR. This alone should be cause for concern to anyone caring the slightest bit about objective truth. The Soviet report on Auschwitz was signed by two proven liars. The Soviets kept their own crimes a secret. Not until 1989 were communist documents released documenting the fact that the Soviet NKVD carried out the Kadian massacre. In 2012, World Press reported their recent findings on the Kadian massacre. As it long was suspected, Churchill and Roosevelt knew that Stalin had ordered the massacre, but kept their mouth shut about it. The US covered it up. On 17th of November 1941, Stalin issued Order 0428, stating that communist partisans would dress up in German uniforms, particularly those of the Waffen-SS, and destroy all settlements within a swath of about 40 to 60 kilometer depth from the main battle lines and to ruthlessly kill the civilian population. It was important to leave a few survivors with these attacks who would report the supposed German atrocities. This method of warfare was also confirmed by German soldiers who captured many Russian partisans wearing German uniforms. The Bolsheviks were purposely sacrificing their own people in these ways to create anti-German propaganda and to instill hatred for the Germans and the Soviet troops. In order to drive the message home entirely, they also had photographed these horrors. The famous photos are now the favorites in the press, used as proof of the alleged systematic mass murder of Jews. The order stipulated, "It is important to have survivors who will tell about German atrocities. For this purpose, every regiment is to form hunter units of about 20 to 30 men strong with the task to detonate and incinerate the villages when working in German uniforms behind enemy lines and destroying those settlement outposts. Among the population, we have to spread the rumor that the Germans are burning the villages in order to punish the partisans." With their free arsenal supplemented by America's finest tanks, Tommy guns, planes, trucks, jeeps, and even food and blankets, the Red Army advanced on Germany from the east. Stalin's plot to take all of Eastern Europe was helped by Eisenhower and Marshall's obsession with invading Europe from England instead of simply advancing from Europe's soft underbelly. By July 1944, the communists had rolled into Poland and advanced into Germany. Stalin's Jewish chief propagandist and prominent member of the Soviet-sponsored Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, Ilya Ehrenberg, instigated the Soviet Red Army rape and murder of German civilians. Referring to German women, Ehrenberg gloated to the advancing Red Army troops, "That blonde hag is in for a bad time." Just like the Jews around Roosevelt, Ehrenberg also sought the extermination and genocide of the entire German people. Ilya Ehrenberg encouraged the mass rape and killing of German women. Ilya's leaflets declared, "The Germans are not human beings. Nothing gives us so much joy as German corpses." As the soldiers approached Danzig, millions of leaflets were airdropped on the troops with a message composed by the propagandist Ehrenberg and signed by Stalin. Kill them all. Men, old men, children, and women, after you have amused yourself with them. Kill. Nothing in Germany is guiltless, neither the living nor the yet unborn. Break the racial pride of the German woman. Take her as your legitimate booty. Kill your brave soldiers of the victorious Soviet army. An unimaginable orgy of violence and rape emerged, which would mark one of the ghastliest episodes in human history. At least 2 million German women, young and old, were gang-raped, sodomized, and beaten, often in view of their children or family members. Parties of soldiers raided houses. In wild orgies of drunken violence, women were penetrated with broken bottles or bayonets. It was all the same whether the communists raped mere children or old women. The women were raped not once or twice, but 10, 20, 30, and 100 times. Mothers were raped in the presence of their children. Girls were raped in front of their brothers. Even terrified women who fled to churches and hospitals were hunted down, raped, and tortured to death. Nuns, little girls, and elderly women were infected with venereal diseases. There were cases of breasts being cut off and victims set on fire after being raped. Some German women were forced at gunpoint to make out with dead, rotting corpses. Pregnant women had their babies cut out of their bodies, some babies had their heads bashed in. A naked woman was nailed through the hands in a crucified posture. A woman 84 years old was found sitting on a sofa, half of whose head had been sheared off with an axe or a spade. Women, including children and old men, were all murdered in a bestial manner. As the final pockets of German resistance in the East surrendered, one girl remembered, rape began almost immediately, and there was a viciousness in the acts.
Hey, it's more than just rape. It's the spiritual massacre, the deliberate destruction of German womanhood by rape. And your husband sees this. He's warned, if you do anything, we'll cut you in half. You see this saw we've got here? We will literally cut you in half.
The most notable offenders were the almost completely Jewish NKVD rearguard troops and the Mongoloid troops from the Asian republics of the far eastern reaches of the USSR. To these troops, the German woman represented everything that they hated about white Europeans. Thus, her pride was to be crushed. Many of the ethnic Russians in the army also regarded these Jewish-led troops as utterly merciless.
By and large, the commissars in the Russian army were Jewish. Now, there was a lot of commissars, but these are the political officers that are in every unit above a platoon, that are there to make sure that everyone toes the party line. Everyone's a good communist. Everyone's a good German hater. In other words, you've got these people, these Jewish commissars, badgering the soldiers to kill more, to kill more, kill more, rape more. And basically, they're the cheerleaders that go along with every unit, roughly the size of a company, I would say. And so you've got these unsophisticated soldier boys, youthful. You've got the Jewish commissars who are encouraging them to do to their dead level best. And so when someone like Ilya Ehrenberg, on the right hand of Joseph Stalin, says it is not only okay, but it's almost a command for you to take the German women, play with them, rape them as often as you want, and then kill them, that sounds like an order. That's sanctified. That's sanctioned by the Soviet government. Thank you.
und dann Frau, komm mit. Und wir haben gesagt, nein, wir gehen nicht mit. Und dann hat er sich die Tochter von der, meiner Schwester Schwiegermutter, also die Schwägerin, genommen und ist mit der rausgegangen. Da war dann, war, muss ja da noch ein kleiner Stall gewesen sein. Jedenfalls hörten wir bloß 3 Schüsse. Dann kam er zurück und dann haben wir ihn gefragt. Ja, hat ihn totgeschossen. Nicht? Er hat sich wohl widersetzt. Und nun wollte er uns dann auch haben und da haben wir gesagt, nein, wir haben auch gesagt, soll, dann lieber soll er uns totschießen. Und dann hat er zuerst die Oma Schlichtenberg totgeschossen. Wahr machen würde uns totschießen, da haben wir angefangen zu beten. Und da haben wir alle zusammen gebetet. Und danach hat mein Vater allen die Hand gegeben und auf Wiedersehen gesagt. Und dann hat er den Vati erschossen. Und dann rauf meine Mutter. Er sah ja nun, dass ich noch lebte. Da zog er mich. Und dann hat er mich vergewaltigen wollen. Und ich habe mich widersetzt und dann hat er mich geschlagen mit dem Gewehrkolben auf den Kopf und dann dachte ich, nun musst du ja ohnmächtig werden. Ich wurde aber nicht ohnmächtig. Dann habe ich mich so gestellt, als wenn ich ohnmächtig bin. Und die ganze Zeit gelegen, hat er mein Herz abgehorcht. Hat er darauf gehorcht, ob ich noch lebe. Und dann hat er mir die Hose aufgeschnitten, alle Sachen aufgeschnitten und hat mich vergewaltigt. Und dann ist er losgegangen. Nein, dann ist er nicht losgegangen. Hat einen Schritt zurück, guckt er in den Kinderwagen, das Kind lebt noch. Dann hat er noch 3 Schüsse durchs Verdeck in den Kinderwagen gegeben. Da habe ich nur gedacht, warum war nicht einer für mich?
Да, никто на это не обращал внимания, наоборот, рассказывали солдаты друг другу, и так сказать, это был такой импульс, так сказать, его геройства или доблести, или как так сказать, что ну, он там переспал с такой-то, понимаешь, женщиной, или одной, или двумя, или тремя, вот так. Даже если кого-то там и убили, ну так мало ли что, потому что война. А подумаешь, большое дело там, понимаете, переспал солдат из какой-то женщины там или девушки.
Thousands of German women committed suicide rather than submit to the horror. Many women drowned themselves altogether with their own children in the nearest river.
Das waren Frauen, also ich habe immer gesehen, Frauen, die ihre Kinder an der Hand hatten und dann zum Wasser liefen. Ja, es waren Einzelne, es waren auch ganze Familien, also ältere Menschen, auch, also ältere Männer. Und viele hatten sich auch zusammengebunden, also habe ich gedacht, was soll denn das? Also weil ich das gar nicht begriffen habe, was sie eigentlich vorhatten. Es waren auch einzelne Personen und Kinder liefen dann auch am Ufer rum, die dann auch ihre Eltern und Familien verloren hatten. Und dann das Bild, auch die, wo schon die Nacht davor ja ins Wasser gegangen waren, eben diese fürchterlichen Bilder, diese aufgedunsenen Körper und ja so rotbläulich. Und dann hat sie uns eben auch geschnappt und wollte und rannte mit uns zu dem Fluss. Und wir beide haben geschrien und meine Großmutter hinterher. Und also wir waren kurz am Ufer, aber sie hat es noch geschafft, dass sie eben, dass wir nicht reingesprungen sind.
Я был в таком состоянии, вот все это колотило, и чех этот еще со мной, который меня спасал, он тут рядом видит, и я говорю, давай по одному, первый подъезд. Трехэтажный, что ли, трехэтажный дом. И такой подъезд, Туда лестница слева, а справа вниз. Подвал. Давай сюда, на допрос. Ну вот, как я вам говорил, у меня был такой трофейный нож. Заходит, ну, бог ему, а не успел сюда, бац, туда. Ну, много перелетов. В нашем организме 70% воды. Это вы знаете отлично. У человека 70% воды. А он незащищенный. Костная система, господи, между ребрами, так, так, так. Ну, вот тут раз, в бок, все, он согнулся. А потом, это то, что у меня там было положено, элементарно. Вот конец, он же острый. Вот в это вот место, вот. Вот в это место. Раз, сюда вышел. Горла нет. Все, ни крика, ничего.
Вы сам это считаете военным преступлением?
Что?
То, что вы делали со своими людьми, с немцами.
Вот это вот данный конкретный случай. Да. Сейчас нет, я никогда не считал. И никогда не считал. Я бы этого не делал, если бы считал.
It is estimated that as many as 2 million German women were raped by Red Army soldiers.
One prisoner was a 14-year-old boy. The guards poured gasoline on his curly black hair and set it on fire. The boy went insane. The men, they were beaten with a Totschläger, a beater to death. It's a long steel spring, and at the end there's a big lead ball, and you use it like a racquetball racket. Your arm, your wrist, and the spring, they deliver a triple hit to a German's face. One of Lola's guards told me, yeah, the Germans in Lola's prison were worse off than Lola. Lola wasn't locked up in a room night and day. She wasn't tortured night after night. She herself had told me, thank God, nobody tried to rape us, the Germans weren't allowed to. But all of that happened to German girls at Lola's prison in Gliwice. Now, the Office of State Security was a Polish government organization. The leaders were Polish Jews. The chief of the office in Warsaw was a Jew. The department directors, almost all of them were Jews. In the province where Lola was, Silesia, in Silesia, the director of the Office of State Security was a Jew. I met him in Copenhagen, little bald-headed man. The director of prisons was a Jew. The secretary of state security was a Jew. And in Silesia in 1945, three-fourths of the officers, three-fourths were Jews. I interviewed 24. And I learned that the Office of State Security ran 227 prisons for German civilians. This one camp, I found the death certificates for 1,583 Germans. In other camps, other prisons, thousands of German civilians died. German men, women, children, babies. At one camp, there was a barrack for 50 babies. They were in cribs, but the camp doctor, he was a Jew, Dr. Sidorovsky, he didn't heat the barracks, he didn't give the babies milk, and 48 of the 50 babies died. All in all, 60,000 to 80,000 Germans died in the custody of the Office of State Security. Jewish reporters who knew about it didn't write about it. There's a working reporter right now in New York City. He was in Poland right after World War II. He tells me, whatever the Germans tell you, believe me, it's true. But he himself never wrote about it. The truth was covered up and was still being covered up.
In February 1945, Stalin traveled to the Black Sea resort of Yalta to attend the most historic of the big three conferences of the war. At the Yalta conference, the plot to reshaping of the post-war world was made. The biggest winner was Stalin. Churchill muttered to Stalin, "We have killed 6 or 7 million Germans, and probably there will be another million or so killed before the end of the war." Communist spies Algar Hiss and Harry Hopkins heavily influenced Roosevelt, and it was decided that after Germany's defeat, the Soviets would occupy Eastern Europe. The Soviets would eventually join the war against Japan and be supplied with US arms for the effort. After Japan was defeated, the Soviets would occupy Northern Korea without Korea's approval, and Manchuria and China without China's approval. Millions of Russian POWs captured by the Germans, as well as Russian refugees fleeing Stalin, would be forcefully returned to Stalin to be executed or worked to death. Germany would be split in half, as would the capital of Berlin. The formation of a communist New World Order, United Nations, would be made after the war. On 28th of April 1945, when total defeat was imminent for Europe, Mussolini attempted to escape to neutral Switzerland, but Italian communist partisans captured Mussolini and his lover Clara Petacci, along with several of their friends. After a sweeping trial, they were both executed near Lake Como in northern Italy. Mussolini was undressed, tortured, and violated, and Clara Petacci was raped several times prior to being killed. Not only was Claretta gang-raped by the communists, but all of the women in the fleeing group with Mussolini suffered the same fate. At the end of the hell, she was murdered beside the man she loved. These human monsters sodomized Mussolini's corpse. They urinated on it and kicked and beat his body until it was barely recognizable as human. The bodies were then thrown into a heap in a suburban square in the city of Milan. At least one British Secret Service member and numerous communists whipped a crowd into a frenzy. They attacked the corpses in all ways possible. Eventually, the bodies were lifted up and hung upside down on meat hooks. An American eyewitness described the crowd as sinister, depraved, and out of control. There was nothing to stop the Allies from taking the German capital before the advancing Soviet army could get there. Roosevelt's lapdog Eisenhower, however, would yet again find a way to delay the Allied advance so as to buy time for Stalin to advance into Berlin from the east. On March 28, Eisenhower even sent a message to Stalin, assuring him that the Allied advance would focus on Western Germany primarily, to give Berlin to Stalin. On April 15, Eisenhower even went so far as issuing a halt order forbidding Allied commanders from crossing the Elbe River. The generals Montgomery and Patton were extremely upset over this order to halt the advance. Eisenhower's orders left Berlin and all of Eastern Europe to Soviet communism. Hitler had heard about Mussolini's death whilst in his bunker in Berlin. By his side was the ever faithful Eva Braun. Surrounded by his high command, they had been there since 16th of January 1945. Churchill's bombings of German civilians and the rape of Germany went on non-stop. By spring of 1945, the situation had become all but hopeless for the Germans. The Red Army had reached the River Oder, which was the last great natural obstacle before Berlin. Germany would now be surrounded from every frontier. The Soviets had twice as many men as the Wehrmacht and four times as many tanks. Stalin claimed that he had 6 million men against the remaining 1 million Germans of every unit the Reich could find. Hitler knew that he was surrounded. Facing a certain defeat, foreign volunteers, old men, women, and children, prepared for the last fight against hopeless odds. Boys of the Hitler Youth also prepared themselves for the last battle. The only thing that stood between heaven and hell was the remaining German troops. On the 19th of April, Soviet troops reached the Berlin suburbs. Every remaining desperate defender of Germany would be eliminated in house-by-house street fighting. The Red Terror couldn't be halted anymore. The combat embraced everyone in its battle zone. Hitler's dreams of a free world had been shattered to a million pieces. Although Hitler had his guardian angel, fighter pilot Hanna Reich, Hanna was so utterly devoted to Hitler that she received an Iron Cross in the Second World War. Reich was also the first woman to fly a helicopter, a rocket plane, and a jet fighter, and on the 29th of April, she flew her light aircraft into the chaotic heart of Berlin to make a daring rescue attempt, offering an exit to Hitler if he wished to escape from the besieged city. Hanna Reich was Hitler's last chance to escape. Hitler told Hanna, "You're a very brave woman. There is still loyalty and courage in the world." But he had already chosen to meet his destiny in Berlin. He would stay. Eva Braun and Adolf Hitler had met when she was just 17, and she worked as an assistant to the photographer Heinrich Hoffmann, who went on to become Hitler's personal cameraman. Hitler and Braun became lovers in 1932. Now, 13 years later, as the remaining German forces were overwhelmed, Eva wrote in a letter to her friend Hertha Schneider, "We are fighting here until the last, but I'm afraid the end is threatening closer and closer." On April 29th, Hitler decided to marry his longtime mistress Eva Braun. The ceremony was concluded with Goebbels and Bormann as witnesses. Hitler signed the wedding certificate, but when it was Eva's turn, she began to write her surname as Braun before crossing out the letter B, and instead writing Eva Hitler. Arm in arm, Hitler led his bride to the study for the wedding reception. Hitler now admitted for the first time that all was lost. Hitler said, "Everything is lost, pack your things and go. You have to leave and within an hour, the last plane will bring you out." After that moment of silence, Eva Braun stepped forward, went to him, and took his hand and said, "But you know, I will stay with you." Less than 2 days after the wedding on April 30th, Hitler and his bride ended their lives together. They had been married just a few hours. Eva took a cyanide capsule, popped it into her mouth, she died instantly. Hitler picked up his gun, put it to his right temple, and fired. Hitler's dog Blondie was also poisoned. Members of the staff carried the bodies in blankets and soaked them with what petrol they could find, and set them alight. Hitler did not want to be handed over to the barbaric Bolsheviks because he knew what they had done to Mussolini. Thus, taking his life and setting his body on fire was his own wish. One day before committing suicide, Hitler dictated his political testament, a suicide note, in which he denied any responsibility for starting the war. Right up until the very end, when Hitler had nothing to gain, he wanted the world to know that he had never wanted war. On the 5th of June 1945, the Allies announced that they would govern Germany from four different occupation zones, one for each of the four powers, Soviet, Britain, France, United States. Churchill had declared war to supposedly defend Poland, but instead allied himself with Stalin, covered up his crimes, and then gave Poland to him. Albert Einstein is today revered as the greatest genius of the 20th century. Einstein was a Jewish physicist and a member of the German Communist Party, a Zionist, and a supporter of the Bolshevik slaughtering regime in Soviet Union. He is credited with creating Einstein's special and general theory of relativity. His writings have been accused of plagiarism by many historians and researchers. One of the most famous mathematical equations in the world, E equals mc squared, was first published by Olinto de Preto 2 years prior to Einstein's publishing of the equation. The equation E equals mc squared should rightfully be called the Preto equation.
He was a commie. He says he was a pacifist, but he wanted war with Germany. He actually wanted to genocide Germans. There was a quote where he said, "The Germans can be killed or constrained after the war, but they cannot be re-educated to a democratic way of thinking and acting. It is hoped that by war's end, they will largely have been killed off." Albert Einstein said this. At Lincoln University, California, Einstein gave a speech in which he called racism a disease of white people and added, "I do not intend to be quiet about it." But he was vehemently anti-nationalist and anti-white, but very, very pro-Jewish. In fact, he was offered a presidency of Israel. He politely declined the offer by saying, "I'm deeply moved by the offer from our state of Israel and at once saddened and ashamed that I cannot accept." He was a hardcore Zionist but opposed nationalism at every turn for Europeans. In fact, he wanted to crush it. So what did he give us anyway? Everything is relative, moral relativism. Nothing is certain. No such thing as an absolute. Anything goes. What is truth anyway? There's no meaning except relativism, of course, right? So only his view of the universe is the right one that we're all choking to death on, right? Many physicists disagree with his theories because that's all they are, is theories. Well, how has he even gotten this big in the first place? Well, it's a fact that his work was not only twisted, unscientific ideas, but that it was science that was plagiarized. I know Red Eyes did a show on this, a great show on this, covering this in detail. His writings included his popular 1924 book, Meaning of Relativity, which was plagiarized from the Lorentz transformation, plagiarism of the mass energy equivalence, largely based on the work of George Fitzgerald and Hendrik Lorentz, Irish and Dutch theoretical physicists. And also the work of French physicist Henri, help me with this, Poincaré.
Henri Poincaré.
There you go. He developed
Henri Poincaré.
There you go. He developed the theory of relativity years before Einstein. And it gets worse. Plagiarism of Paul Gerber's, or is it Gerber's, groundbreaking work on the speed of gravity. Okay, this was a German guy. And the idea that the speed of light was a constant and was independent of the motion of its source was not Einstein's at all, but was proposed by the Scottish scientist James Maxwell in 1878. Also, Berhard Riemann, a German, was the first to develop a sound non-Euclidean geometry, which is the basis of all the math he used to describe relativity. Also, it goes on, Heinrich Hertz, the father of the unit of frequency, Hertz, right, sound vibration, discovered that electrodes illuminated with ultraviolet light and they create electric sparks more easily. Well, in 1905, Einstein published the paper explaining this same experiment from Hertz's photoelectric effect, and it was actually Hertz's discovery that led to the quantum revolution. Yet Einstein was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1921 for the discovery of the law of the photoelectric effect. Okay? It goes on. Nikola Tesla, he could not stand Einstein. In fact, he called him an old crank. He gave a scathing analysis of Einstein's relativity theory, calling it a magnificent mathematical garb, which fascinates, dazzles, and makes people blind to the underlying errors. The theory is like a beggar clothed in purple whom ignorant people take for a king. He said this in 1913. 1935. John Murray Kudahy, a brilliant known sociologist, said Einstein was motivated by a desire to distort and destroy Western science. Very, very accurate. Dayton Clarence Miller, president of Britain's Royal Astronomical Society, disagreed with all Einstein's theory. He had his own absolute space theory, which is interesting. And it goes on, 100 prestigious Austrian and German scientists denounced him in this book, I'll pull it up right here, accused him of being a pseudo-mystic and just speculating everything, basically. 100 scientists. H.L. Mencken, there's sound reason for believing that Einstein will not hold up in the long run. His curved space may be classed with psychosemantic bumps of Gall and Spurzheim. Two other brilliant scientists. So the point is, we wouldn't be in the Stone Age without him, hardly. We'd be cultivating other planets by now, right? And then people who say, oh, you're just jealous of him, or, oh, it's because he's Jewish. No, it's because he was a thief, a liar, and a plagiarist, and an awful person in his private life, and, true brilliant people couldn't stand him, and they viewed him as a crackpot, and a liar, and a plagiarist, because he was. And Einstein criticized scientists he felt threatened by true geniuses, like Erwin Schrödinger, quantum theory, Werner Heisenberg, Hilbert, Planck. He was actually the jealous one who was attacking all these, but he was propped up as the archetype of brilliance, genius in science, the smartest man alive, and he was a Jew, right? So he's just a pure creation, basically, of a Jewish media hype that was manufactured in the 20s, basically like a pop star. But he was a commie who failed his college entrance exam and shamelessly ripped off true geniuses. So he's all smoke and mirrors. He's a fraud, people. And I don't know if you guys have heard this before, but it's massive. Germany, Henrik, as you said, was thriving. I mean, just amazing minds were coming out of Germany in this time. It's not like Einstein took Germany out of some kind of Stone Age and they were not going to advance without his brilliance, right?
While Europe was still at peace in 1939, the development of the American atomic bomb was proposed by Albert Einstein, Eugene Wigner, and Leo Szilard, all Jews, to Roosevelt. They wrote a letter to him in which they described the power of a potential atomic bomb. Einstein falsely insinuated that Germany was already working on an atomic bomb and urges Roosevelt into building such a weapon. Out of this effort emerged the Manhattan Project, in which the development of the atomic bomb was done. The leader was Robert Oppenheimer. Developers were Richard Feynman, Owen Chamberlain, Enrico Fermi, Edward Teller, John Neumann, and others. On the afternoon of April 12, 1945, Roosevelt died in a massive stroke. The failed businessman and KKK member, Vice President Harry Truman, now became president. Roosevelt's Jewish and communist inner circle continued to run the show, while Truman from Missouri delivered the speeches. In April and May 1945, Japan made three attempts through neutral Sweden and Portugal to bring a peaceful end to the war. In August, Japan tried via neutral Soviet channels to negotiate surrender. Every peace attempt made by Japan would also be fruitless. Ignoring the Japanese pleas for peace, the Allies would instead prepare for major attacks on Japan. The United States Air Force had carried out bombing raids against around 60 Japanese cities such as Tokyo already in 1942. Now on the night of 9th to 10th of March 1945, 2,000 tons of the exact same type of incendiary bombs dropped on Dresden 1 month earlier was employed in the genocidal terror bombing on Tokyo. The order came from Air Force General Curtis LeMay to fly as low as possible and to bomb the Japanese homes and other buildings which were made of wood or paper to cause as much havoc as possible. Thousands of civilians were burned or asphyxiated to death. The burnt bodies of 100,000 dead civilians covered the streets. Millions of innocent Japs were injured and left homeless. The bombings would be repeated on May 23rd and 25th. American Air Force General Curtis LeMay boasted that the American bombers were driving the Japanese back to the Stone Age. This, however, would later be overshadowed by the following atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These bombings resulted in the immediate deaths of around 100 to 150,000 in Hiroshima and 60 to 80,000 in Nagasaki from injuries sustained from the explosions and acute radiation sickness, and even more deaths from long-term effects of ionizing radiation. Between the two bombings, Stalin broke the Soviet-Japanese Non-Aggression Pact of 1941 and declared war upon an already beaten Japan. Soviet troops even began pouring into Manchuria, overwhelming the Japanese forces there. Japan surrendered on 15th of August 1945. General Patton warned about letting Stalin get to Berlin before the Americans. After a visit to ruined Berlin, he wrote to his wife on July 21, 1945. Berlin gave me the blues. We have destroyed what could have been a good race, and we are about to replace them with Mongolian savages, and all Europe will be communists. It is said that for the first week after they took Berlin, all women who ran were shot, and those who did not were raped. I could have taken it instead of the Soviets had I been allowed. As the war now had ended, the Jewish genocidal Morgenthau Plan was implemented for the total destruction of German industry and the enslavement of the German race. The winners would now basically starve millions of Germans, mostly civilians, to death, to inflict collective punishment on the German people. Germany's real nightmare was about to unfold as the communists imposed a collective punishment upon Germany that would make the Versailles Treaty shrink in comparison. In the greatest act of ethnic cleansing the world has ever seen, the Allied powers imposed a new reign of terror, destruction, looting, starvation, rape, and mass killing of the German people. The occupying Allied armies carved off 25% of Germany's most fertile land. The German refugees were then attacked and raped by the Red Army, as well as Jewish partisan gangs who seized and occupied the stolen homes of the German refugees. Churchill supported the expulsion of 15 million occupied German civilians from territories they inhabited. More than 3 million Germans died during the forced migrations, about 2 million civilians, mostly women, children, and elderly, and 1 million prisoners of war. In between 1939 and 1945, around 7 million German POWs were loaded onto cattle cars and transported to the Soviet gulags. The majority of them would never see their families again. Stalin issued Order 270, which meant that all Russian prisoners captured by the Germans would now be sent to death camps and later executed. Even their wives would be sent to the gulags. German civilians and anti-communist allies everywhere were rounded up, raped, sodomized, drowned in cesspools, tortured, genitally mutilated, burned alive, and executed. Rows of bodies were hanged in the trees. Cruel punishment was meted out against hundreds of thousands of those labeled as Nazi collaborators, whose only crime was in making peace with Germany, or to have fought against the Soviets on the Eastern Front as members of the German SS units. French women who dated German soldiers during the occupation were humiliated by having their heads shaven bald or stripped naked. anti-communist refugee families who had followed their German defenders as they retreated from the East were shipped back to Stalin as well, where they were subjected to torture, including rape of the women. Stalin also held 25,000 American POWs and 30,000 British in his Siberian gulags, and even rapidly started executing many of them. Stalin never released the rest of them, and they perished in the gulags. As part of the psychological reprogramming and warfare known as denazification, the German people were deliberately subjected to anti-German propaganda, hunger, psychological trauma, and homelessness. Starving German women sold their bodies to American soldiers in exchange for food, soap, or cigarettes. The Allies worked fanatically to fulfill their genocidal pact with Stalin. "We ought to get rid of them all as soon as possible," wrote an impatient Winston Churchill. "Don't mind the 5 or 4 million Germans. Stalin will see to them." "You will not have trouble with them. They will cease to exist." In his diary, George Patton noted, "Today we received orders in which we were told to give the Jews special accommodations. If for Jews, why not Catholics, Mormons, etc.? We are also turning over to the French several hundred thousand prisoners of war to be used as slave labor in France. It is amusing to recall that we fought the revolution in defense of the rights of man and the civil war to abolish slavery and have now gone back on both principles." He wrote to his wife on the 23rd of July 1945, "If what we are doing to the Germans is liberty, then give me death. I can see how Americans can sink so low. It is Semitic, and I'm sure of it." Within the first hour of the first liberation of the Dachau prisoners of war camp, 122 SS guards were shot after surrendering to the US 45th Division. Another 40 SS men were beaten to death by the inmates. Another 358 SS men were rounded up and herded into an enclosed coal yard. Initially, 12 were machine gunned. The rest were executed shortly thereafter. Totally, 560 men who had surrendered were murdered during the liberation of Dachau. This was a brutal war crime. Still, the US soldiers went unpunished. A US soldier said, "The men were deliberately wounded guards. A lot of guards were shot in the legs so they couldn't move. They were then turned over to the inmates. One was beheaded with a bayonet. Others were ripped apart, limb by limb." In May of 1945, Churchill betrayed tens of thousands of Croats that had surrendered to them. Instead, he returned them to Soviet and Yugoslav communists, resulting in the Bleiburg massacre. General George Patton was disgusted by the genocidal policies against the German people. Patton knew that the policies for the genocide and destruction of the German people originated from the Jews in Washington, D.C., surrounding Morgenthau and Roosevelt. In a letter to his wife, Patton wrote, "Evidently, the virus started by Morgenthau of a Semitic revenge against all Germans is still working." Even before the war had ended, thousands of German prisoners of war had died in American captivity from starvation, mistreatment, and outright murder. A survivor from one of the camps in April 1945 wrote, "Each group of 10 was given the outdoor space of medium-sized living room. We had to live like this for 3 months. No roof over our heads. Even the badly wounded only got a bundle of straw. And it rained on the Rhine for days. And we were always in the open. People died like flies." The Allied commander Eisenhower was in control of over 5 million living enemy soldiers. "It is a pity we could not kill more," muttered the general, dissatisfied with the body count of the greatest slaughter in human history. "God, I hate the Germans," Eisenhower had written his wife in 1944. Because the Geneva Convention guaranteed prisoners of war of signing nations the same food, shelter, and medical attentions as their captors, and because these laws were to be enforced by the International Red Cross, Eisenhower basically just dodged the treaty by creating his own category for the prisoners.
He suggested a new class of prisoner, disarmed enemy forces, DEF. Prisoners the army would not feed. Get that? They would not feed after Germany's surrender. Altogether, the Allies had between 7 and 8 million German prisoners. They captured 4.2 million before the new DEF status, similar to another type, surrendered enemy persons, SEFs. Author Giles McDonough writes that the latter captives, about 3 to 4 million, and I quote, were not entitled to the same levels of shelter and subsistence, unquote. The Soviets had not signed any agreements regarding humanitarian treatment of prisoners of war. Therefore, they were not obligated to treat their prisoners humanely. The Allies intended to use the Germans as slave labor, also according to the Morgenthau Plan.
To cover up his crimes, Eisenhower issued an order asserting that the Red Cross officials were not allowed access to his death camps.
I think Jim Bach has made a major historical find here. To me, as an American historian, I'm ashamed. There was sadism, brutality, denial of medical supplies that were available, denial of water in some cases. When they were right on the banks of the Rhine, men died of dehydration.
From my own experience, I saw that the wounded were left unattended. No one cared. We were treated just like cattle. There was no camp, just the Rhine meadows, which later turned into a swampy morass. There were no tents or shelter of any kind, and they had robbed us of everything. We were all freezing, shivering with cold, lying, squatting. We tried to find a dry spot and lay there, in the open, of course.
I was a guard at a U.S. Army prison camp, and I was warned not to speak about what I experienced or I'd be in trouble. Well, the conditions in the camp were abominable. We neglected to feed them properly. They got a can of watery soup once a day, and it was so inadequate they were throwing grass and weeds into it when I could find them. They were starving, and we did not have enough water for them even. We were near the Rhine River, so they would crawl under the wires in an effort to get some water, and we'd machine gun them when they did that. They had no blankets, no tents. Some of them had no overcoats, and they were sleeping in the mud. This was April, towards the end of the war. And it was a cold late spring, and so they were dying in great numbers. And what impressed us, all of us, of course, were the trucks hauling the bodies away.
So when we were shoved off the boxcars, we were driven into the meadows in a big pack. And at the very beginning, we were told over the loudspeaker, "You are not regular prisoners of war. You are disarmed enemies, and therefore do not fall under the Geneva Convention." And we were also told, to make things perfectly clear, on Eisenhower's order, in English and in German, that they had not come to free us from National Socialism, but to eliminate Germany once and for all.
After 2.5 years, I weighed 30 kilograms. I had lost my homeland. I had lost most of my relatives. And I was all by myself in East Germany. And I just wanted to get home, but we never got home.
Millions more Germans died of Allied action after the war than during the war. Certainly 9 million more dead Germans in the 6 years of peace, only because of Allied policy. The Allied governments covered up this tremendous national slaughter and are still doing so.
The subject is a forbidden subject, and in the United States, it's a subject we don't want to investigate. So for these reasons, the subject has been covered up to an extent, just denial of it, not looking at it, not researching, destroying records.
Immediately after World War II, the Jewish poet Abba Kovner founded the organization called Nakam, consisting of a group of Jewish partisans. Abba Kovner had spent his latest years illegally smuggling Jews to Palestine. Even though the war was over for everyone else, this group was so unsatisfied with the death tolls of Germans, they started hunting down Europeans and killing them randomly.
They put on the trucks, "Die Juden kommen." The Jews are coming to frighten the population.
השכבנו אותו לאוטו, שם לתוך איזה יער, וביער כבר חיכו חבר'ה ככה, עשו משפט. והוא נשאר ביער, לא יצא יותר מהיער. במקרה מסוים גם יריתי. ככה שהאיש הזה ש... אני זוכר מקרה אחד, תחפור את הקבר שלך. אז רבע שעה הוא חפר, אני עמדתי... והוא חפר, כשהיה קצת יותר עמוק שאפשר לשכב בפנים. בום וזהו.
One of their objectives was the deaths of 6 million Europeans through poisoning their water supplies. They wanted the Germans to experience the horror of indiscriminate murder. This plan was called Plan A. Plan B was to poison a few thousand loaves of bread at the bakery that supplied 4 prisons and concentration camps, including Dachau, where the Germans now were interned by the Allies. As a first step, Kovner was sent to Tel Aviv to win the support of the Jewish leaders in the pre-state Israel for the plan to poison Germans. Israeli president and chemist Chaim Weizmann was receptive and approved of the plan. Chaim recommended a scientist who would make poison for them. The scientist worked at the Seif Institute in Rehovot, later renamed the Weizmann Institute. Returning to Europe on a British ship, Kovner was arrested by the British police, who apparently was familiar with the plot. At that time, Kovner carried enough poison to murder the inhabitants of 4 major European cities through their water supplies, but he was instead sent to an Egyptian jail. Plan A had failed. The rest of the organization regrouped back in Germany, and the Lithuanian-born Jew, Joseph Harmatz, took over the NACAM leadership. He abandoned the idea of poisoning the water supplies of the Germans. Instead, the group acquired a small quantity of arsenic and reverted to the more modest bread poisoning plan.
And then we decided that we're ready to do it.
One Saturday night in April 1945, they broke into the Stalag 13 camp at Nuremberg, and with an artist's brush, Harmatz painted 3,000 loaves of black bread with poison.
Smelled 3,000 breads, which was enough for 12,000.
About 2,280 SS men ate the bread, he said, but could not say how many or if any died. News reports at the time said more than 200 people were hospitalized, but made no mention of deaths.
לפי מה שסיפרו לי אנשים אחדים, כולם עשו שטיפות קיבה והצילו את כולם. ולכן לא עשו חקירות.
But what I know is that the American army has mobilized all the ambulances, and they had thousands, and they were carrying them to all the possible hospitals, and they were pumping out.
Harmatz lived out the remainder of his life, respected and honored by his fellow Jews. The genocidal terrorist, Kovner, was quietly released into Jewish Israeli hands after only a year in custody. Next year, the Jewish terrorist group Irgun disguised themselves as Arabs and bombed the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, killing 91 people. Menachem Begin was the leader of this terrorist group. In the future, he would be known as the Prime Minister of Israel. Despite his racist and supremacist views and his terrorist background.